Welcome to The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We're going to talk about that orca whale you may have seen apparently grieving for its calf. That's coming up in just a moment. But first, we're going to begin with the news of the day that the deadline is today for the Trump administration to reunify thousands of families separated at the border. My guest is Megan Casey, a lawyer at the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. She's worked with parents waiting for reunification in Washington. Welcome to KUOW, Megan.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
How many parents has the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project worked with in Washington state?
Well, originally in Washington, the count was at around 50 parents were detained either in SeaTac or Tacoma. And that was back in June when this policy began rolling out.
And how many of those parents are still in custody here?
Well, there's several parents still in custody, both in SeaTac and Tacoma. But we have had a number of parents who have since been released and reunited with their children.
All of them reunited with their kids?
No, not all of them have been reunited with their children. There's still several parents who remain detained, and also many parents who have not yet been reunited, although they may have been released from custody.
Why is that? Why are they not reunited?
Well, there's it's unclear the reasoning, but there's a process that the children go through in order to be released from federal custody, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, We don't have a lot of detailed information about what has caused the delays in the children being released to their parents.
And I understand you have at least one client in this situation. Can you tell us about that?
I do. I had a client who was detained in SeaTac, then transferred to Tacoma, and was released on bond last week. She was then reunited with her family in Texas. However, her 15-year-old child remains in the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement as of this morning.
Why is her 15-year-old still in custody?
I don't have information about why he remains in custody. I know that the family has been working very hard to comply with everything that has been asked of them in order to secure his release. But unfortunately, she still remains separated from her son.
And is she subject to being deported?
As of all of the other parents, will, if they were released, will remain in removal proceedings and have to attend future hearings in immigration court in order to present their cases before an immigration judge to try and remain in the United States safely.
We've been hearing that many parents have been deported without their children. Are any parents in Washington state in that situation?
I do not have personal knowledge about any parent in Washington that has been deported. But again, that's just my knowledge base. Doesn't mean it hasn't happened.
Finally, Megan, do you expect the Trump administration to meet today's deadline to reunify those families?
Well, I think based on the trends that we're seeing, it seems unlikely, given that it appears that, as late as this morning, parents are still separated from their children. So it does not look promising at this point.
It sounds like you're not in much of a position to predict what's going to happen next.
I think it's very difficult. There's a lot of moving pieces, people being transferred from one place to another. So, yeah, I think it's difficult to say what's going to happen.
I've been speaking with Megan Casey, an attorney with the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. And again, today's the deadline for the Trump administration to reunite children and their parents who were separated at the southern border. Megan, thanks for the update.
Thank you very much.
More of The Record coming up in just a moment. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting this show at KUOW, so come join us. This week, our local orca pod, the J-Pod, thought it had something to celebrate. A new orca was born on Tuesday. And for these endangered southern resident whales, every birth is critical. But within a half hour, this new calf had died. And its mother has spent the last 2 days with her baby on her back and the rest of the pod slowly swimming behind her through the San Juan Islands in the Haro Strait. To human eyes, it sure looks like a funeral procession and another reminder of how fragile the Northwest orca population is right now. Let's learn why this matters with Dr. Jason Colby, Associate Professor of Environmental History at the University of Victoria. He's also the author of Orca, How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator. Dr. Colby, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks for having me on.
Have you seen those photos of this orca carrying her dead calf?
I have indeed. Really, really heartbreaking.
I was reading in the Seattle Times about how when the calf will slip off her, she'll dive down and get it again.
Yeah, we've seen this kind of behavior in certain species of cetaceans, and it's really, you know, without anthropomorphizing too much, it's really hard to avoid concluding that this is mourning. This is mourning behavior, and we've seen it in other species of dolphins, and it's heartbreaking to watch, especially when you realize how precious each of these calves are.
Yeah, it sure looks like grief. Is that not anthropomorphizing an animal too much?
I mean, anytime we project, you know, human emotions on, there's a danger of that. But I think it's pretty safe to say, you know, the scientists that have observed this say that this is a mourning behavior.
I saw a scientist from the Center for Whale Research, Ken Balcom, said maybe this is her protest. I don't know if he meant that literally.
Yeah, I mean, that's maybe a bit of anthropomorphizing.
Metaphorically, but, though, perhaps.
But, you know, Ken has been a really outspoken and effective advocate for the real, you know, dangers that these southern residents face. You know, they're you know, on the brink of extinction, we think. And he's been a pretty loud and outspoken voice for the need for them to have enough food. I mean, that's really the fundamental issue here. I mean, there are other questions, you know, pollution, acoustic pollution, boat strikes, you know, all kinds of problems. But the main issue for them right now is that their primary food, Chinook salmon, king salmon, its numbers have been falling steadily the last few years and really in the last century. They're very specialized predators, and they almost exclusively feed on those, we think, and they're starving. This population is starving, and you see the real impact with their lack of reproductive success.
What's wrong with the Chinook salmon?
Well, I mean, the Chinook salmon numbers, for a number of reasons, you know, are remaking of the great rivers of the Northwest, you know, the Columbia in particular, but those in Puget Sound, the overfishing, just the industrialization of the area. We've seen this, you know, this used to be an area famous for not just gigantic Chinook, but gigantic Chinook runs. And if you think about this population, the southern residents, like the northern residents in northern BC, they developed a strategy over time of relying on these the largest salmon as food, which made sense as a large predator to, you know, most efficiently get calories was to catch these largest salmon. Made sense for the effort, but now they're stuck in a potentially a dead end here because they don't seem to be able to adjust to the dropping abundance of their main prey item.
You write about how we've changed how much we care about this situation. We've changed our view of the orcas. I grew up calling them killer whales.
Absolutely. I mean, this was a change that was stunningly rapid, and it went in tandem with the transformation of the Northwest from a sort of a working class extractive region where people fished and, you know, it was mostly fishing and logging to an area where we increasingly went out on the water for fun and recreation and saw wildlife not as a threat to us or to our resources, but something to be enjoyed. And this is probably the most striking example of this. You know, people growing up in the 1950s, 60s, even through the mid-60s, heard about them as blackfish, as killer whales, potentially menacing creatures. And now they are icons of our environment. And yet the great irony is we've stopped shooting them. We've stopped, you know, harming them outwardly. And yet the development of the region, the industrialization, is what seems to pose an existential threat to them now.
In fact, Jason, your family's part of that story.
Absolutely. I grew up in the region, grew up on both sides of the Salish Sea, actually both sides of the border. My father in the 1970s participated in live captures of orcas on both sides of the border in 72, 73,
why?
Through 76. Well, at the time they were being procured for aquariums, marine parks. And, you know, in hindsight, this is a really, now that we know how few southern residents there are and the damage those live captures did, it's a really, you know, tragic to look back on. At the same time, and this, my book sort of writes about the complexity of this history, those live captures and the display, and especially the live study of them by scientists in captivity, was really transformative in the way people understood them, not just seeing them first as individuals, you know, really for the first time, but as sentient creatures with relationships. And so captivity and live study in captivity is really what brought about modern killer whale research, which has now, you know, transformed the way we think about wild killer whales. The fact that we, you know them as individuals and think about these precious individual relationships actually started with that industry. That doesn't, by the way, make it any easier for someone like my father to live with the guilt of taking these animals out of the wild.
Is he living with that guilt?
Yeah. I mean, it's complicated because, you know, people live their lives forward. They didn't know at the time that these were, you know, small, only, you know, small resident pods with incredibly limited reproductive capacities. They didn't know at the time that they had been, you know, probably in free fall because of other human violence, shootings and such. But, you know, when in the 1970s and early 80s, the research really ramped up on them, it became apparent how few there were. But it's also worth people remembering that you know, this population, the three pods of southern residents, J, K, and L, they did suffer tremendously from live capture, but their numbers rebounded to nearly 100 from their lows, probably in the high 60s or low 70s, rebounded to nearly 100 by the late 90s. In the last 20 years, they've crashed. And that has nothing to do with live capture. I mean, certainly that affected their demographics, but really what seemed to have hit them in this free fall in the last 20 years is loss of food, loss of prey availability.
Just before I leave your father's story, can you tell me how would he capture orcas?
Oh, well, he worked for Sealand of the Pacific in Victoria in the early 70s. He was the curator there, and there was several captures that they conducted in Petter Bay, which they used to procure whales both for Sealand and for sale elsewhere. And then he worked on this side of the border for the last capture that happened in Puget Sound, right off of Olympia in Budd Inlet. The Seattle Marine Aquarium, which was then owned by SeaWorld, captured a group of transient orcas, we now know, within sight of the state capitol, just after the state legislators were debating making Puget Sound a sanctuary for killer whales. And by the way, Ralph Monroe, who was an aide to Governor Dan Evans at the time, was actually out on a sailboat with friends, was horrified by the sight of this capture and became a lifelong advocate for orcas. And so it was a really transformational moment for many people involved.
By the way, we're live tweeting this show. I've interviewed Ralph Monroe about just that, and maybe we can link to that. Join us at KUOW. Yeah, he was. There were explosives going off, and you know, people throwing the nets. So you said that live study in captivity has been important, has been a good thing for the orca population. What about shows? You know, SeaWorld jumping.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly debates about this, and most people, I think, most sensitive people that appreciate wild orcas now will admit that, you know, the choreographed shows in SeaWorld are, you know, in their eyes at least, you know, don't really represent orca behavior accurately. At the same time, when they were first displayed on the Seattle waterfront and in Vancouver and in San Diego in the 1960s, they gave a really different optic to this animal than people had before. I mean, previously, the impression people had of killer whales is that they were not just, you know, omnivorous and voracious and you know, toward other marine life, but could potentially eat people. I mean, the U.S. Navy diving manual warned to always get out of the water if killer whales ever approached, and because they would attack people, you know, if they were in the water. So the sight of an orca swimming with a person and not consuming that person, you know, and this first happened on the Seattle waterfront on Pier 56, when Ted Griffin, the owner of that aquarium, swam with Namu, the world famous killer whale, in 1965. This was a transformative moment for people in the way they viewed this apex predator. It was written up in National Geographic, got coverage all over the world, and probably most importantly, gave the first access of scientists to confirm, that orcas use echolocation. First chance to really, record their calls to figure out how their diving physiology worked, but also just to get to know them as individuals. And that's really, that was a new form of science. The only kind of science study of killer whales prior to that time that was being conducted, it was being conducted right here in Seattle, what's now the National Marine Mammal Laboratory. The only kind of study they did was to go out and shoot and dissect orcas and examine their stomach contents. Mm. So this is the first time that anyone was studying them, as well as, you got kids and future scientists seeing these shows and seeing these orcas as potentially friendly to people.
By the way, this is Dr. Jason Colby. The book is Orca, How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator. How did we turn against orca captivity? Because there's only one freeborn orca still in captivity, I think.
There's one southern resident still in captivity. That's Lolita,
Miami. Captured,
yep, in 1970, and right off of Whidbey Island.
Yep.
She's still in captivity. There's another a northern resident named Corky too, who's in captivity in San Diego. Mm. I'd say there's a fascinating dynamic that occurs here, right? In the sense that as they're brought into human space and into human culture, and people get to interact with them and view them and watch them, get to know them on an individual basis, that their understanding of them is transformed. You start thinking about them as individuals. Start thinking about them as individuals with relationships that were being severed by the captures. And in fact, the sight of the captures and the sounds of the captures, in Puget Sound in particular, was really transformative in this. People saw these captures, especially a big one in Penn Cove where Lolita was caught in 1970, was a transformative moment for how people thought about these animals, because, even though the affection was rising for the public, they hadn't sort of seen the sights and the sounds of these captures, heard orcas calling to one another, seen the separations that the nets created, heard the calls as they were being raised up onto trucks. And this had a really powerful impact on people. Many of whom I interviewed described the sounds of the captures as just being etched into their minds, that they could hear like it was yesterday, even though it's been almost 50 years. And so I'd say that, all those things, getting to know them in captivity actually made people want to appreciate them more in the wild. Really, the argument you didn't need to take them into captivity if you're in the Northwest, because they're right there, passing through. Mm. And certainly the sights of these captures. And then ultimately, the realization of how few there were was really the pivot point, I think, when Northwesterners in particular turned against captivity.
Do you think, I don't know how well known the grief of an orca is, do you think that this week's photos and video of an orca carrying her dead calf on her back, Is this one of those moments?
Well, I'll tell you this: pictures can tell stories, and we saw, for example, in the Vietnam War, how a couple of really iconic photos turned people's minds or raised people's attention. And I think that these photos of this mother carrying her dead calf tell a story. And who knows if she's trying to tell that story, but it tells a story for us. And the story is that we've failed them, right? This is a population that transformed not just the way the Pacific Northwest views orcas, but helped transform through science, through the founding of Greenpeace and its anti-whaling missions, helped transform the way the world views whales. I mean, this is more than any other cetacean population on Earth. This was the population that changed us, that transformed us. It made us better people, I would argue.
Why better people?
Well, I think because we started to think differently through them, how we treated the marine environment, and what we were putting into it, what we've been taking out, and ultimately they become icons for an environment, the Salish Sea, that's in crisis. And we're better people in the sense that we don't view the Salish Sea, I don't think, as an inexhaustible resource we can just dump raw waste into and take an unlimited amount out of. Now, a lot of the damage is already done, but the question is, can this story help generate the attention to help save this population? This population has gone through a lot and has paid a pretty heavy price for our slow change in our industrialization, our development. And so the question I would love my fellow Northwesterners on both sides of the border to ask themselves is, what do we owe them? Do we have a moral debt to them for what they've given to us to help make us better people?
If we decided we owe that moral debt, we would do what next?
There's lots of things we can do, but, and this is a hard thing to hear, but stopping commercial fishing and sports fishing of Chinook salmon until there's a recovery.
Should we not eat local wild salmon?
I wouldn't say to not eat local wild salmon, but wild-caught Chinook from the Northwest, which, you know, frankly, a lot of the Chinook, the kings that we eat here are from Alaska, which is a different question. You know, there are all kinds of questions about, you know, indigenous fishing rights that are really fraught on both sides of the border, especially in Washington, and I don't mean to question those rights.
You're not questioning indigenous fishing rights?
No, I'm not. And frankly, it wasn't indigenous fisheries that did the damage, ultimately, to the Chinook salmon runs. But we do have to ask ourselves if we should allow, you know, sports fishing in Puget Sound, which still goes on, even though Chinook salmon runs here, many of them are listed as endangered. That's one thing. Allowing some of the rivers to be undammed and healed and allow them to heal, you know, such as the Upper Snake, as another step. And then I think ultimately, as much as we can, reducing marine noise and pollution going into Puget Sound in particular. Yeah.
The Trump administration is talking about rolling back parts of the Endangered Species Act. I mean, that could affect the Snake River Dam debate, for example. How do you expect the Trump administration policy proposals would affect orcas?
Well, it won't help. I mean, I don't, you know, weakening the Endangered Species Act, which is also more attenuated than many people realize, when, in the sense that there's always, you know, questions of you know, balancing commercial development versus protection of endangered populations. Anytime you move to weaken hard-won environmental victories, can be a real threat. And certainly, we're talking about a population that's sitting on the edge of a knife here. I mean, it's not a question of they might be endangered. They may already be on the road to extinction, this population. And so anything that moves in the opposite direction of you know, providing less protection is obviously going to put even more pressure and more strain on them.
One more question, Jason. You said a moral obligation. Why not just enlightened self-interest obligation?
Well, there's certainly enlightened self-interest, and I think in the sense that I think a lot of people fail to realize what a large part of the economy now the southern resident orcas are. I mean, they're a draw on both sides of the border for, you know, dozens of ports now offer whale watching. About 500,000 people come, and just the people that pay for whale watching cruises in a number of about 500,000, not to mention all the people that go out on their own boats to see them in kayaks and such. So we're talking about, you know, millions and millions and millions brought in the tourist industry for them. I would also say there's an enlightened self-interest in the sense that the southern resident killer whales are the canary in the coal mine, so to speak, meaning they're at the very top of the food chain in the Salish Sea. And if they're starving, and if their bodies are so toxic they have to be treated as hazardous waste when they die, something's really wrong with our ecosystem. And people need to realize that. A lot of people are newcomers to the Salish Sea that have moved here, you know, from other parts of the world and the country. And I think they tend to see this area as pristine and beautiful. You know, you move here for the nature, but actually they're seeing an ecosystem that's a shadow of its former self, and a badly poisoned and depleted one. And this animal, this iconic apex predator, is telling us that with their bodies, with their pain, right? The pain that this mother is showing.
Dr. Jason Colby, Associate Professor of Environmental History at the University of Victoria and the author of Orca, How We Came to Know and Love the Ocean's Greatest Predator. We're talking, among other things, about the passing of yet another orca calf this week. And if you want to hear more about Jason's book, he was in town last month. You were here at Town Hall, and your talk is online, and we recorded it at KUOW Speakers Forum, so we'll link to that conversation as well. Dr. Jason Colby, thanks for coming in to KUOW.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. We're going to be right back. It's The Record on KUOW. Thanks for tuning in.
I feel a sin coming on. I feel a rock that's about to go wrong. I got a shiver down to the bone. I feel a seeing coming on.
There's a story behind that song. Well, the song is by the Pistol Annies, but right now it's being used in a Seattle burlesque show. And that story is about sexuality and colonization. And here to tell you the story is Professor Kim Tallbear. She's an associate professor at the University of Alberta's Faculty of Native Studies. Her work touches on social science, genomics, environmental policy, and decolonized indigenous sexuality. We'll explain. Welcome, Kim. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me on.
You're in Seattle hosting this burlesque show called Sexy Science Confessions. It's at Kane Hall, University of Washington, tomorrow night, 7:30. How did this show come to be?
Well, this particular show is especially themed around science because I am on the faculty of the Summer Internship for Indigenous Peoples in Genomics, or SING, and we do a week-long summer training program for aspiring Indigenous scientists every summer, and we move around to different universities in the country. And I've been doing that since 2011, but then I started doing the sexuality research, and we were talking at last year's workshop, and we said, hey, let's bring those two things together. And so we decided to do the show at this year's workshop.
Yes. What does science have to do with sexuality and burlesque in this show?
Well, you know, science and sexuality have both been central to colonialism. So a lot of what this workshop does is not only teach basic science, but we also contextualize genomics and biology within the colonial project. So how have studies of race on Indigenous people, Black people, and other people been central to building up these research fields and institutions? A lot of people don't know that genetics research institutes were often, before World War II, eugenics research institutes. And then, of course, when World War II happened, scientists really started to think much more critically about their use and study of race. I have learned in my work that I can bring a lot of those lessons studying race and genomics into studying science and sex and colonialism. So, for example, Indigenous people, like other people of color, have been hypersexualized. Our sexualities and our bodies have been seen as deviant. So whether a biologist is studying them or whether a sexual researcher is studying them, we have been portrayed historically as these less evolved kind of deviant people.
Well, you said a bit, everyone doesn't maybe not know as much as you do about it. Hypersexualized and deviant. Oh. What do you mean?
Well, hypersexualized means like we're especially sexual. And of course, sex gets treated as this thing that's supposed to be private and whispered about and kept secret, right? And a lot of what we try to do in our show to counteract that history is to be very open about sexuality and to talk about consensual, good, pleasurable, positive sexuality. So it's not just this stigmatized, secret, private thing.
What was behind that distortion, that picture?
Well,
deviant picture.
Well, I think histories of racial hierarchies have included not only putting races into hierarchies according to intelligence, but also according to what their sexual practices were. And so you had at the turn of the 20th century, the United States, whether it's scientists, the church, or the federal government, really enforcing compulsory monogamy. We know a lot of Indigenous people come from non-monogamous peoples historically. They were enforcing state-sanctioned marriage. This is all tied up with private property. So sexuality and private property all kind of come as a bundle in the way that colonialism happened. And so there's a lot of us historians, anthropologists, Indigenous studies scholars who look at these histories. And what we're doing is trying to bring some of the lessons of those histories combined with performance to the stage to teach people about having fun, positive sexuality. And that does kind of work to help us move away from those dominant racial narratives about bad sex, right?
Yes. And without giving the show away, but to draw us in, we say more about what happens on stage.
Well, we're not just a burlesque show. We do usually have a burlesque performance. We're originally a sexy storytelling show. So we have people who do stories, spoken word. We've had a stand-up comedy meets an academic lecture, and then we have burlesque generally. And so this week, I think we've got one performer lecture / burlesque dancer, and then we've got several storytellers or poets.
Okay. And what's the vibe like at the show? If I come to the show, it's going to be like what?
Well, it's mostly really fun. Like, you'll leave with your cheeks hurting. You're laughing so much. You'll hear hooting and hollering because we have some very salacious confessions. The audience submits their own confessions to our condom fairies who circulate throughout the audience and get your confessions cards and then hand out condoms and lubricant.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the confessions get read on stage between the performances, it's a whole lot of fun. Sometimes we get a confession and a performance that's not just funny or titillating, but it could be quite moving because Indigenous people, like a lot of people, are overcoming sexual trauma, right? We're in this Me Too moment where people are talking a lot about consent and overcoming bad sexual experiences. So sometimes you'll get somebody who will talk about overcoming trauma, and it's a really moving moment. I've had to stop myself from tearing up sometimes when I've read those confessions. But it's positive in that people say, look, I've come to a place of positive sexuality after trauma, and this is an amazing development for me.
How do your performers push back against this? We called it colonized sexuality. I played a little bit of music earlier on. Maybe you can tell us about what that is, what's happening there.
What that performance was like? So that's not going to happen this time. That performance happened at our Vancouver show at the Chan Center last year. One of my graduate students at the University of Alberta is a PhD student. She works both in Native Studies and in Literature. And she did a piece. She's also a country music singer, gorgeous voice. Her name is Brittany Johnson. And she co-founded with another one of our grad students, the Beaver Hills Burlesque Collective. And Beaver Hills is the English translation of the Cree name for Edmonton. And So she did this piece to I Feel a Sin Coming On. And what she did was combine literature with burlesque. So there was a big controversy across Canada last year. A very famous fiction writer named Joseph Boyden, who was the darling of Indigenous literature in Canada, he got outed as having fabricated his Indigenous ancestry. He's a white guy. So he wrote this book called The Arenda, which was this prize-winning novel in Canada. A lot of people in Lit know The Arenda. So Brittany came on stage and she was dressed in this very puritanical kind of outfit, a high-necked white shirt and a long black skirt. And she started stripping down while she was reading the Bible because she heard this I Hear a Sin Coming On song, and she starts getting all hot and bothered and starts stripping down. You think she's reading the Bible, but at the end of the striptease, it's actually The Arenda. And she picks it up and she rips it in half. And so it's sort of like an Indigenous reclamation of Indigenous voice, because he was getting a lot of grief for kind of posing as an Indigenous person and speaking to Indigenous issues. So you kind of have to know the literature politics, but everybody in Canada knew this last year.
Oh, yeah.
So it was, yeah, people were screaming when they saw the end of this performance in the audience.
Is there a moving or a boundary breaking performance you've seen at this show that even changed you?
Yeah, you know, and I'm not sure all of the audience reacted this way to this one, but also in Vancouver, we had several burlesque dancers come from Virago Nation, which is an Indigenous burlesque troupe in Vancouver. And there was one of the dancers, she goes by the name Mother Girth. And she had this very sexy, sequiny, revealing dress on, but she brought on powwow music and started dancing like a men's fancy dancer to this powwow music. And the difference between men's and women's fancy dances, the women's is much more your legs are closed, your skirt's long. It's very athletic, but it's a lot more proper. Men's fancy dances, you spread your legs a lot, you get down on the ground. It's very, very athletic. And she started dancing like a man in this, and it was just, it's really amazing. You know, and at the powwow, when men's fancy is the last event of the night, it'll happen at midnight, the crowd's up and cheering, and that's what was happening at this burlesque performance, but you don't see women doing it. And I really felt like she was bending gender there. She was pushing back against how women's bodies are supposed to move and what's proper for women's bodies. It was just, again, very moving for me, as well as exciting and interesting. I felt kind of teared up almost.
And when people are walking away together from your show, what are you hoping they're taking away?
Well, I've actually heard in our parent show in Austin, Texas, Bedpost Confession says the same thing. That's a non-Indigenous version of what we do. They say that, like, couples, people that are, you know, in relationships will come away saying, we went home and we had a really open conversation about our sex life and about our relationship. And so I hope that people will leave in a way where they feel a little bit healed or more open to sexuality, a place of moving away from shame, you know. And it's not that privacy is always a bad thing, but oftentimes we want to keep sex private because we almost feel implicitly like it's a shameful thing that should be kept quiet. And I want us to get to the point where we can speak more openly about positive, pleasurable sexuality.
This is Dr. Kim Tallbear, and she is a faculty member at the Summer Internship for Indigenous Peoples in Genomics, an annual training program that'll be going out with a bang tomorrow night.
Thank you.
This event is called Sexy Science Confessions, and as you heard, it's stories, it's spoken words, sometimes it's stand-up comedy meets academic lecture, it's science, and it's all happening at 7:30 tomorrow night. That's August 27th, tomorrow, Kane Hall, University of Washington. Dr. Tallbear, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for coming to KUOW.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
And stay tuned. We've got more of The Record for you coming up.
Give me tall, dark, and handsome. Mix it up with some strong. I feel the sin coming on.
The Record on KUOW. We are live tweeting this program at KUOW. You really ought to join us. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. Is this the end of the showbox? The outcry yesterday was immediate after new documents showed a developer is planning on bulldozing the concert venue, and they plan to replace it with a 44-story, $100 million apartment building. Here's a sampling of the reaction from KEXP. DJ Dusty Henry says, if they go through with demolishing the showbox for condos or offices, it will exemplify the city's blatant disregard for its own spectacular arts community. A couple other tweets. I'm sorry, Seattle, but you're willing to let the showbox be torn down? WTF is wrong with you? Why do you hate the things that made you great? And finally, oh, Seattle, you're killing me with your rush to soulless boomtown. That last tweet from Kurt Schlosser, writer and editor at GeekWire, and he's sitting next to me. Thanks for coming in, Kurt.
Thanks, Bill. Good to see you.
There's also a petition to save the showbox by declaring it a historic landmark. That petition got 20,000 signatures in less than a day. It's now upwards of 31,000, and it was started by Seattle comedian Jay Middleton, who's on the phone. Jay, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks for having me.
I'll start with you, Kurt. Soulless boomtown. Now, we definitely are a boomtown, but what? High-rise dwellers have no soul?
This is, you know, a lot of what I saw on social media yesterday was sort of the enough is enough. Have we not achieved this status yet of driving everything cool away? We're going to drive the last cool thing away. Probably not the last cool thing, but that sentiment that we are at this point where we're just exasperating people to the point where they're just throwing their arms up and they're ready to chain themselves to the front of this theater music venue in the heart of downtown.
As the band Thunder Pussy said, we'll chain ourselves to the showbox.
Yeah, it's frustrating. It's a frustrating sentiment to have to express for something that you love and where there's a lot of history and a lot of cultural value.
Well, we do have a lot of new people here. Kurt and Jay, maybe we should run through some of the bands and acts that have played at the showbox. What comes to mind, Jay?
Well, honestly, that's the venue that when I was a musician, like an active musician, that's the first show or first venue I ever played in a band. So that's like, when I heard about this news, it was heartbreaking for me. But like, I'm standing on a stage where like some of my favorite like metal, grunge, punk bands have been on there. But then as a guy who studied music through the years, of learning about jazz, rock and roll, you know, I mean, when you hear like a name like Duke Ellington, like making it big, like and doing shows at the showbox, that's history. That's a horrible idea to just rip out history out of a city that, I mean, in the 90s was defined by grunge music. And so you're taking and ripping out like a cultural icon that's a landmark out of the city. This could be this. I mean, it's about even that's worse than ripping the Sonics away from the city.
You got Kurt's eyebrows to go up there.
it's disrespectful.
It's been a music venue since the late 30s, 100-year-old building, but a concert venue since then.
Yeah, I think the Sonics equivalency is interesting because certainly sports fans were as hurt by that, and the city as a whole, and culturally the removal of that team. I think the Showbox sort of would exemplify that a bit. You know, I read a post by Charles Peterson, the famous grunge photographer, yesterday on Facebook. He wrote to the city and included some of his images. I mean, he made a name for himself photographing bands in that venue. He's seen 100 shows there or more, and said that his grandparents danced there in the 30s and 40s. You know, pieces of history like that are important to share and to remember in this town, as so many people new come here for new jobs, and so much changes and comes down in the process.
But, you know, one of the things that happens with all the newcomers is that prices get driven up. Then we hear, what do we need to make Seattle affordable? We got to build. We need more housing so it gets cheaper. Do you feel no conflict there, Jay?
I feel a little conflict because I work in Ballard and live in Lake Stevens because I can't afford to live in Seattle. You know, it's a little rough for me to think like we're going to be building more when I can't already afford to live anywhere close here.
Yeah, I think the presumption that whatever's being built, especially in a 44-story tower in the center of downtown, is going to be suddenly affordable for people who can't already afford the city is misconceived.
Well, let's get back to the soullessness idea. Like this seems like to many people a referendum on what Seattle is, on Seattle's soul, on what makes it great and special. What does make Seattle special?
Speaking for myself, I moved here in the mid-90s, 1996, when I was in my mid-20s, and I moved here specifically because of the cultural boom that was happening here. I didn't move here for a tech job. I moved here because Seattle was on the map for the music that was being created in this place, and it was a beautiful place and still is. But I think that culture needs to be kept in place. Otherwise, you're left with mountain views and skyscraper views and the Space Needle. And is that enough to sustain a place if you drive out the people who create the art and can afford to live here on money that they make by creating art? I think it's important to hold on to those institutions in that segment of your population.
What do you do with the idea that you thought Seattle was cool when you felt cool, that every generation wants to preserve the Seattle, that, yeah, Jay, your first band played there, of course you feel that way, but here come new people. There was something there before the show box and something before that, and that was stolen land to begin with. You know, that it's all, that what are we preserving here? What do you do with that?
I guess you're preserving the music culture that helped define this city, I mean, during a good portion of the 90s, but you're preserving culture of music throughout decades and decades, not just music, but also art. We're not just talking about music. We're also talking about burlesque. We're talking about comedy. We're talking about all sorts of theater throughout the years of that club, you know, just from the 30s and on.
Why is it important to you that it's in the same location? Jay, you live in Lake Stevens. Why not spread the love? I mean, the art has always gone to places where it's afforded, or at least it draws enough people that it can be afforded there. So it could be, the showbox could be in Lake Stevens or Federal Way.
I grew up in Kent. And my parents would drive me into Seattle for things when I was a kid, for us to go explore the city and to go explore different things. And when you see the culture, the architecture around you, the bright lights, like when you're at night and you see that showbox marquee and those bright lights, your eyes twinkle and the imagination runs wild and you wonder what goes on in there. There's the mystique of it, and it keeps your mind racing and going. And that's what, I mean, like I come to the city. It's got the culture in the city. Why remove it and put it somewhere else and get like a half off flavor taste? You know what I mean? It just doesn't feel the same at all. It doesn't feel organic. When you sit in that building, you feel the ghosts. You feel it, and it's a really good feeling.
What about you, Kurt? You don't want the showbox on a flatbed truck and haul that
around. Yeah, the same reason this developer wouldn't build their 44-story tower in Lake Stevens. They want to be in the city that is booming and making a name for itself, and they want to be in Seattle, just like all the people who are coming here. You don't, when you think about going out on the town in Seattle, you don't think about getting in the car and driving 30 minutes away. You want to go right downtown.
So, Jay, you began this petition that I mentioned to give the showbox landmark status. And clearly it's an 80-year-old music venue and a 102-year-old building. Other than that, what's your case for landmark status?
It's surprising to me it already hasn't been made one. Like, to me, like, hearing that it hasn't been made one, it just kind of shocked me when I heard that. And so it kind of got concerning. A friend of mine actually said it to me on, like, a comment on Facebook saying that we should petition it for this. So I said, you know what, I'll just go ahead and just start it.
Yeah, and it's doing pretty well.
It is doing well.
And I'll tell you this. I didn't think it would get this big, honestly. I did not reach out to any media. I did not reach out.
Does the city of Seattle take into account your petition? I mean, they have their own guidelines for what's landmark status. Is it associated with a historic event or the life of an important person in the history of the city? You know, they have like six or so criteria. Does your petition matter?
I mean, you have hundreds of Rock and Roll Hall of Fame bands that have probably walked through that venue, and then you also got two of them that have historically played there as well. I mean, Pearl Jam is one of the most recent Rock and Roll Hall of Fame bands, and they've played there, I bet, numerous times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the Stranger had a good take on the petition, the landmark status, what the city's role is, how that process sort of plays out this morning. And this won't be a short process by any stretch, and there'll be many public meetings and votes if this does move forward. The Stranger said the developer may in fact initiate the landmark status purely because it takes so long. They want to just go ahead and be out in front of that. So we'll see what happens.
By the way, yeah, we don't know for sure that this developer is the buyer. Right now, the Showbox is owned by a strip club magnate. We figure maybe that's who he's selling to. We talked to Jeff Shulman about this. He hosts the Seattle Growth podcast, and he's a professor at the UW Foster School of Business. Listen to this.
Live music is still very much alive in the city, and hopefully this symbol will catalyze people, those people who care about the Showbox, to push for places for the arts, whether it's new venues or housing for artists or space, rehearsal space.
If the Showbox is going, and we certainly don't know, we're a long way from knowing that, but does that energy go? Is there something people can do besides be mad with that energy and love for music and historic venues?
There are plenty of venues still in this town. It's still a great place to see music, whether it's in the neighborhoods around town or in the downtown core. I went to a show at the Neptune last month that I very much enjoyed. I was out at the Gorge, which is a huge national stage for bands. It's just you take away one and then the next one comes and then the next one. It's just this ripple effect that has got people down. And whether it's the house next door to you that stood there for 100 years and suddenly becomes a cookie cutter box, or it's your favorite club, it just doesn't seem to be ending as Seattle grows and grows and grows.
Jay, do we need anger to save the Showbox? Like, I love old buildings. I was so sorry when the Music Box got torn down. That might be before you got here. But, you know, this is an ongoing thing. And one way to look at it is everything changes. Everything turns to dust. People, if this is a new apartment, I love those people too, and I hope they'll go and support arts, you know, the hundreds of them up to the sky. And but we have landmark status. We love old buildings, so maybe we're not going to let that happen. Maybe Thunder Pussy's going to chain themselves to a place they love, and we're going to say, no, we're going to save this building. But does it have to be an us versus them? I see a lot of online F these, you know, a-hole developers. Do we have to do it that way?
No, we don't have to do it that way. There's a smarter way to do it. There's a more political way to do it. We all have to work together as a group that loves the Showbox rather than a group that hates this developer. Mm-hmm. And that's the only way that I see it foregoing. That's the only way I can see it foregoing, you know? And the thing is, like, to me,
wow, what's wrong with the angry? But a bunch of people signed the petitions. It seems like it's working so far.
You know, there's always going to be anger on the internet. There's always going to be anger on the internet. I mean, it happens with jokes every day. It happens with comedians every day. And honestly, like, that's never going to go away. But usually half the time that I see, if there's somebody angry on the internet, they're pretty neutral in person.
Mm. That's Jay Middleton knows about comedy. He's a comedian and a band, a former band member who played the Showbox. Mae West, Al Jolson, Duke Ellington, Pearl Jam, the Ramones, and Jay Middleton's band, okay, at this historic venue. And Kurt Schlosser, a writer and editor, GeekWire, uniting in love, trying to save the Showbox Theater. After that announcement this week, developer plans to bulldoze it and build a residential tower. Jay, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you.
Kurt, thanks. Good to see you.
Thanks, Bill.
The Record on KUOW Seattle, and thanks for tuning in. The show's produced today by Amina Al-Sadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Allison Bruzek, Sophie Reed, Jason Pagano. Thanks to Casey Martin for extra help today. Social media producer Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. Tomorrow it's our Week in Review. We'll dig into the big stories of the week with our panel, so join us.